Just like making sausage, you probably shouldn't watch this. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Barry, it's good to be back with you here. We're doing the rarest of the rare. We're together in studio, which we never do almost anymore. We used to do it every day, and then we were down once a week, and now we're once in a blue moon.
Well, weather's better, and I find myself on Thursdays having to come back to Columbus because, well, our legislature is in session, and so no man's life, property, or future is safe while the legislature is in session, so therefore I've got to be up here.
Boy, ain't that the truth.
It is very much the truth. And as a matter of fact, Chuck, that's one of the things we're going to be talking about extensively today is our state legislature, because as we know, it's the end of April, and beyond the NFL draft that's later on, and by the time this airs, it'll be over with.
Will there be anybody available after all the arrests and accusations and indictments and whatever else?
Well, I thought we were not talking about the legislature just yet.
Okay, sorry.
Maybe
sorry.
We'll get there.
I misstepped.
Maybe
yeah.
We'll get there. No, but again, you know, we're at the end of April, and that means that we're deep into a budget process in Ohio. The state operating budget document, which is called House Bill 49 this session, started out as about a 3,000-page document. Now, some of us have to read through all that stuff, and it gets to be quite hairy. And you find all these little lovely bon mots that they throw in there that you can basically, you know, make hay on and laugh and figure out whose ox is getting gored, etc. But when we get to the end of April, it's time for the House of Representatives, where the budget has to start, the Finance Committee, to basically fish or cut bait, as they say. It's time for them to start making changes to the proposed budget that's brought in by the governor's folks and to put their own stamp on it. Well, that process is taking place this last week, and it'll be voted on the coming week. And that budget... Now, Chuck, if you know that we've got a fiscally responsible, conservative Republican majority in the House of Representatives, right? You understand that.
Oh yeah, that's
make
what
sure,
I was
make
completely
sure,
my understanding.
We want to make sure that we're fully clear on that before I say what I say next. And that is that one would expect that with that kind of a philosophy, that kind of DNA coming from our legislators, they would be looking for places. Because when the governor introduced his budget, he introduced a budget that grew spending over the biennium by almost 6.5%. So they're going to cut, right? They're going to cut it harshly. They're going to cut to the bone. They're going to cut it so that when they introduce the substitute version of the bill, which they just did, we're recording on Thursday, they introduced it on Tuesday, it's going to look sleek and streamlined, you know, like it had Weight Watchers or something. Is that what you believe?
Supposedly. Is that what I believe?
Is that what you believe? No, of course not.
This is a rhetorical exercise, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, yes, okay. It is. Well, that budget bill went from about 2,800 pages to 4,503 pages long as a substitute bill. Now, you know, I was just, as you see here in the studio, I've got the paperwork here. I have got a printout of all of the changes that were made to the budget since it's been introduced, and this is the sub-bill. Now, that document is 14 8.5 by 11 pages of single-spaced 10-point type.
Wow.
Bullet points.
Wow.
14 pages worth. There are so many changes in this bill. Well, I'm still trying to catch up with everything that they've done.
All I can say is sin abounds where there is a multitude of words.
Well, then there's that too, I suppose. Now, what we're looking at here is this isn't the end of the process, though. Because by the time this airs, the House Finance Committee will have, and they've already started, Chuck, they substituted the bill with over 300 amendments that they took. And these were amendments that people, the other members, were offering and submitting during the process. Now, they're having hearings today. They'll have hearings on Friday and most likely on Monday before they go back, try to vote it out on Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. There will likely be another change to this budget, and it's called the Omnibus Amendment. Now, the omnibus amendment is all of the things that they had to figure out, how, you know, playing their trade-off games, that they couldn't quite take just the standalone amendments to just do some quick fixes. This is going to be the big one where all of the big horse trading gets done in order to make sure they've got enough votes when they go to the floor to pass the bill over to the Senate. Now, again, and that's a key thing for folks who don't understand the process, just because the House passes the bill doesn't mean that this stuff takes place and goes into law. The bill goes over to the Senate, who've already started hearings weeks ago, and they've had in the agency heads and the special interests saying their pieces. The Senate's already lining up what they want to do to the budget document, and you know, and they've stayed somewhat apprised of what's happening with the changes in the House before they happen. And then they're going to go, and during the month of May and into June, they're going to be doing what they need to do to fix their particular, you know, constituencies' needs. And then that final bill will pass out of the Senate, and it'll have to go back to the House to say, hey, we agree with everything you did to us. Well, that doesn't happen. We always have a thing called conference committee.
Yeah.
And so the conference committee meets, and they supposedly work out the differences between the two chambers, and the only things they can discuss are things that were in one of the two versions of the bill, or both versions of the bill, to tweak them to get to which one they take, whether they take the House change or the Senate change. Sometimes, though, new things get added during that process as well. I've seen it happen before.
Yeah.
And then, at the end of June, June 30th, it'll go to Governor Kasich to sign. And, of course, then, because we have line item veto power in our Constitution for our governor, he gets a chance to take out the veto pen and cut out some things that he doesn't like. Like he did last fall when he vetoed out the heartbeat bill provisions from another piece of legislation. So, all that being said, this is the crazy season where you see a lot of strange things come up in a budget because, again, the House will put a lot of things in there knowing that if it becomes too radioactive, then the Senate might bail them out by getting rid of it. And then when people cool down, then they might be able to put part of it back in conference committee. That's kind of a little bit, you know, and again, my take's a little bit more Machiavellian on this whole thing. I don't trust that they're all, you know, goodness and light, looking to do the best thing
not
they can do
necessarily
for,
looking
for everybody
out,
in the state of Ohio.
Not necessarily looking out for the constituents' best interest.
Sometimes not. Now, there's some other things that happen, too, and around this budget cycle, and it happens out and about in the various agencies and the special interests. And we, in order to talk about that a little bit more in depth, and especially about a couple of things that have taken place over this last week or so, we've brought a special guest to join us on the program today. And I just want to take a moment to introduce our guest and a little bit of background. And then, since I probably will do such a bad job in butchering that, I'll let them, you know, basically say what they want to say about themselves. Our guest that we have today on the program is Cindy Reese, who is the managing editor of the blog Third Rail Politics. Now, I love Third Rail Politics' logo, their slogan says, "We touch what they won't." And I like that because if you read, and you and I have used some excerpts from their blog for a while.
Yeah.
If you read through, there are some serious things that they touch on that you will not see coming from the mainstream media or the mainstream political media. And so Cindy has been at the helm of this for a while. And Cindy, I want to just welcome you to Third Rail Politics, because I'm listening here looking at it. Welcome to Principles and Policies. We love having you on today.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, Barry. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Well, good. Now, Cindy, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, I just basically did a short thumbnail sketch, but tell us a little bit about your background and why you are sitting at the helm of Third Rail Politics.
Sure. So I've had an eclectic career. I spent some time working in early childhood education. I actually spent the last 12 years working on that issue, trying to bring together pastors and other community leaders to find the best ways to help our kids who are in poverty. And that's an important thing to know, because as we begin to discuss some of the issues that we're going to talk about, people should know that my heart is really with the community that is, in my mind, the most vulnerable, and I have a real passion to try to help that community. I began my career working years ago for the Ohio News Network. I was producer of an evening talk show, political talk show, called Ohio's Talking, and went to work for the state legislature, where I met Barry Heath, Then I went on to work for an organization called the Council for a Strong America, and that is where I spent the 12 years working on those issues related to poverty. I had the opportunity to take this position last September as the editor of the Third Rail Politics, and it's been an enormous opportunity to really discuss things in a manner that you will never hear in the other newspapers. And I hope that should people check our blog out, that they will discover that we try to really, we go to great lengths to connect and link in the facts and the research that we use to build our articles. And so I think you're going to hear the other side of the story when you check out our blog.
Make sure you give the URL for that blog.
Thank you. It is www.3rdrailpolitics.com.
Yep, Third Rail Politics with the three actually number-wise, .com. Now, Cindy, you know, you had mentioned your background and your passion for kids in poverty and underprivileged. I understand that you were doing a series in your blog regarding the role of poverty in education, and basically a larger series on poverty. And you know, there's some very fascinating things, but then you came out with another piece just shortly thereafter, as you're seeing some things that are happening around the state budget that are troubling.
Yes, absolutely. So we're doing an in-depth series, a four-part series, focusing on the impact education has on, or lack of education has on poverty. And obviously, it's significant. So if we want to address a major crisis in our country, we really need to address education. So what we just discovered just this past week is that the Race to the Top funds, the Department of Education determined to return $49 million of a $71 million grant. Those dollars would have gone to expand charter school programs, and those programs, charter school programs, were developed to help the most vulnerable kids in our community. They were designed to be implemented in the Big Eight urban communities that were failing drastically. Almost 20 years ago, even 20 plus years ago. And so to see the government send back, or to see the Department of Education send back $49 million was really heartbreaking. But what's even more interesting is that they kept $22 million. And they kept $22 million because it benefited primarily one entity, and that's the Thomas Fordham Institute. The Thomas Fordham Institute provides as the sponsor of 11 charter schools, and they've been instrumental in trying to single-handedly take down the rest of the charter schools and pretty much create a monopoly.
Well, and I think that's interesting that you bring that up, because I know that sometimes, especially with our listeners, when you say Race to the Top, you know, they immediately connect that policy or that initiative with Common Core, which is the expansion into our local schools of basically federal education, federal control of education, and it's one that many of the legislators have been making quite a bit of book on in relation to wanting to see it gone from Ohio, to get rid of, to repeal Common Core. Now, wouldn't they believe that maybe turning back this money is actually a way to help get rid of Common Core in Ohio, or is that just a feint by the Department of Education?
I think at this point we have two options. I mean, the money's gone. The $49 million, they've already given that back. And since there is an alleged collusion with the $22 million, they probably should just send it all back. Get rid of the standards for Common Core and just allow local school superintendents and local school families who are members of school boards to determine the curriculum that they need. Common Core was used as a tool to bring, or Race to the Top, excuse me, was a tool used to bring Common Core to the state of Ohio. And that is because we had a failing, if you remember, President Bush had No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. And apparently we owed over $300 million back to the government because we never implemented it correctly. So when Governor Strickland was governor, he worked on the Race to the Top grant, and President Obama suggested that if they include the Common Core in the Race to the Top grant, there would be a forgiveness of the funds that had not been implemented properly before. So there's a really long history. This is not necessarily related to our current governor. There's just a really long history of the Department of Education not really managing education change and policy effectively and efficiently. And the damage has been such that 84% of our schools in Ohio, and most people are not aware of this, but 84% of our schools in Ohio received a D or an F on the most recent report card by the state of Ohio.
Wow, 84% of the schools received a, well, it was basically a failing grade, a D or an F.
Absolutely.
On the report card. You would think that parents would be outraged across the board about this type of situation. Now, again, you had mentioned that this money, the $49 million, was connected to charter schools?
Yes. Yeah, so the way the grant was written, they wanted to, the money was, $71 million was provided. It was written into the grant to do a charter school expansion. And very interestingly, we've learned that the Fordham Institute served on the committee that was doing an analysis of how this grant would be implemented, and you come and find that they changed sponsor evaluations in House Bill 2 last year. And it's a really important thing to talk about. It's a complicated story, so I apologize to your listeners because it took me a while to wrap my head around it myself, not firm even there.
And that's fine, Cindy. Maybe it would help our listeners a little bit if you maybe went back and unpacked a little bit about the role of the Fordham Institute in all of this, because kind of starting in, said that basically the $22 million that the state decided to keep was actually going to directly benefit them. And so maybe if people had a little background on this, we could get a better handle on it.
Absolutely. So the Thomas Fordham Institute was founded in the 50s. So there were these wonderful leaders in Kettering and Greater Dayton, who had been very successful, and they created a foundation that was designed to give out grants to their local community, grants of all different natures. And once the Mrs. Fordham passed away, the attorney for the Fordham Institute reformulated the foundation such that it was going to be education-focused, invested the funds in a manner so that it would have longevity, and basically changed their focus to be one of promoting education excellence, or that alleged education excellence. What has come from that is they from that point moved from Dayton, where they still have a strong influence, to Washington, D.C. They've created what I would call spin-off organizations, which they fund and create to help promote their policy goals. So, for example, let's say they want to promote Common Core. They received over $100 million from the, not $100 million, they received about $8 million from the Gates Foundation to implement Common Core in Ohio. And so what was once considered a conservative foundation, by the way, of course, was thrilled to take the money. And then they have these spin-off organizations that do research and things of that nature. No one knows that they're connected, and they'll write a report about how great Common Core is, and then Fordham will bring out the report, and then they'll bring in experts from their other sibling organizations to say this is fantastic, and really just bolster in a very, I guess I would call it a fake policy wonk way, bolster this initiative to make it look like there's widespread appeal for this research, when in fact every single person who's involved in the process is funded by the same organization and was created by the same organization. So the Fordham Foundation, funded in significant fashion, especially in Common Core by the Gates Foundation, went on to support Common Core, which created standards for the state of Ohio, not only for curriculum, but also for measurements. And these measurements that they've generated are the measurements that have changed the way we rank our schools such that 84% of them are failing. And I will use myself as an example. I live in Powell. I live in the Olin Kennedy School District.
Uh-huh.
Last year, at this time, our school was ranked number one in the state. It is seventh from the bottom now due to these standards. So you have to ask yourself, did it really change dramatically? Did all of a sudden all the teachers change and the education formula changed so much that all of a sudden we're seventh from the bottom? But of course it did not. What it did is they were implementing this formula that the Gates wanted and funded to help move forward their Common Core standards. And the result of that is that you have 84% of schools failing. And if you don't mind my going on taking that picture one step further, why does
go
it
ahead.
Impact families? Obviously, the school superintendents aren't bragging about it. They have different levies and things they want to get passed, so they don't really want people to be aware of the fact that their schools are not doing well. But the reason this is so critical is because you have kids, and I can use the number, you're the top of your class from the number one school last year, and you're trying to get into Harvard. That is perceived differently by the admissions of, let's say, a Harvard than it is this year when you're the number one kid in your school, but your school's seventh from the bottom. It doesn't sound as competitive. It sounds like it was pretty easy to become number one because your school wasn't that challenging and that difficult. So there's a lot going on in the Department of Education. I would argue that people need to really begin to pay attention, get with their school superintendents, learn more about what is happening because it's going to impact our kids. We have next year, Barry, 34,000 kids are not going to graduate because of these new standards that they've implemented.
At the very least, Cindy, it was my understanding, and I think a number of school superintendents came up earlier this spring and held a rally outside the State House, basically saying that if the legislature didn't make changes and get them out of this nightmare called Common Core, that at least half of the graduating class of 2018 won't graduate.
Isn't that extraordinary?
And that's statewide. That's not one or two schools. That's statewide.
There were school superintendents from across the state, and they even said at that time they were frustrated because it's an issue that it's complex. But I'll simplify it for you. One organization, Fordham, received $8 million to make this happen. A lot of other people did too. The Chamber of Commerce, the Ohio Business Roundtable. Gates Foundation gave a lot of players a lot of money because they wanted Common Core in the state of Ohio. But it financially benefited one. It financially benefits the Fordham Institute. And the problem that it has is that it brings in Common Core state standards, and these standards have literally tanked our education system. They've done all of this very quickly and dramatically. They argue that they want to have everybody be college ready. And yet we have all these technical and career jobs that are going unfilled. Not everyone is going to be ready to go to college. I actually spoke to you earlier about my passion for the community that lives in poverty. Just getting these kids to graduate from high school is a significant accomplishment. They may be the first kid in their family to ever graduate from high school. It's rather remarkable to think about. And the impact that has, the difference between having a high school diploma and a GED or no diploma whatsoever, is the difference between you having a job and a future or living on government assistance and having no hope.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, as I'm looking here on Third Rail Politics on your article that you put out there about the ODE turning this money back, one of the things that you basically have said that and it seems to me like there's, if ODE said, well, we're going to return back part of that money, but the part that benefits our buddies over here in this special interest group, we're going to keep. It seems like there's a track record. You had mentioned that basically in December, and I'm looking in the article here, that you wrote, actually, that said that the Third Rail, that your blog uncovered sponsor manipulation by the Department of Education. That's the sponsors of the charter schools, because a charter has to be sponsored by a group or an entity or something or a company. That there was manipulation by the department, which has resulted in 60 of the sponsors being ineligible to apply for the federal charter expansion grant. Well, no wonder they're turning back $49 million if they basically eliminated 60 of the... Now, how many sponsors were there originally, Cindy?
Well, there were 64 in this particular group.
So 60 of the 64 are no longer eligible to participate.
Isn't that amazing? Because suddenly, you know, it's just fascinating to me. I mean, so it's all a measurement. It's a way of measuring something. And it's like saying, it's like the Department of Education decided one day that 4 plus 4 equals 8. Well, it does equal 8. Excuse me, 4 plus 4 equals 10. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get to that number 10, because you're not going to, because it's not accurate, right, and not accurate measurement, mm-hmm. then you're going to fail. And, you know, the people who managed to meet the measurement were the people who created it. And you'll see the name again and again. You will see Fordham was a part of every single one of these entities. But in terms of the Department of Education, people need to know that because this impacts everyone. Whether you go to charter school or whether you go to public school, they have a measurement called value add. Value add is a measurement that they use. They consider it proprietary. Nobody can see it. Nobody knows what the formula is. Nobody can even see the contract with a company who created the formula. It is a big secret, and it's manipulated through by whomever at the Department of Education. And shockingly, the four schools that did well with that measurement are the people who were a part of the team who created all of these new rules and standards, and everybody else failed. So.
Well, you know, and I guess that, you know, gives me an awful lot of warmth and confidence in my soul with it, with our department, that they basically have measurements that they're measuring schools by, but they won't tell anybody what they are. How do you actually, as a school, whether it's a charter school or a public school, how do you ever hope to meet those standards if you don't know what they are?
If you consider the state's largest online school, which we write a lot about, ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, and some other charters, they're not the only one. But I think it's an effort, a national effort, frankly. I think Ohio's ground zero to get rid of school choice. And I think it's like a perfect storm. So you have Fordham Institute, who likes school choice because that's what the business that they're in, but they're trying to create a monopoly, so it's only them. And then, so they feel like if they can push out all the others, they're going to control it. However, my guess is, it's like, you know, the saying, when they came for the Jews, I wasn't Jewish, so I didn't care, right? So my hunch is that the Department of Education, which is abundantly staffed by teachers' union folks, will be very happy to get rid of Fordham at some point when they're done using them. And that's just my personal opinion. It has nothing to do with facts. I can't prove it at this point.
Well, and that's okay. We throw a lot of personal opinion around on this program, too. It's okay.
Well, I really try so hard to be able to validate everything we say in our blog, just for the record. So so I do want to make that distinction. But they have... I apologize. I've somewhat lost my track of mind. And it's your fault, Barry.
No, it usually is. It usually is. But you were talking about, you know, the fact that supposedly the Fordham Institute seems to have been, they're trying to get the monopoly on all of these schools so that they can control them and run them, but probably it's going to come back and bite them in the end because...
Ohio being ground zero for the end of school choice, you have to remember that charter schools were created, and I know we're not just here to talk about charter schools, but charter schools were created, once again, to be experimental. They weren't designed to be heavily regulated by the Department of Education. They were designed so that we could go into these pockets of poverty which have unique challenges of course, who wouldn't love and dream of all these children having the opportunity to go to college? Mm-hmm. What a great goal. I'm all for it. But the reality is, I think our real goal should be getting these kids out of high school and having them be prepared for the workforce and for life. Really, let's simplify it beyond that. The real goal should be to teach them to learn so that they can learn for a lifetime. So what they've done is, we're ground zero. They want to get rid of charter schools. So the Department of Education, once in the middle of a school year, they changed the rules. They changed the policy of how they're going to measure charter school evaluations, and they put them, especially for online schools, and they put them into effect in the middle of the school year, and they knew that online schools did not have the physical capability of doing that type of measurement, and basically pretty much just set them up to fail. They did that without going through the proper legislative process, through JCAR, and now there's a lawsuit about it to see what the net result will be. But the mere fact that the Department of Education would play games with people's education in that manner is rather stunning.
Well, and
it should be their sacred trust to get these kids to graduation.
Well, you'd think that would be the mission of the Department of Education, yeah. That would probably, most people would think that's the mission of the Department of Education, is to see kids actually succeed in school and graduate. But, you know, it creates an interesting juxtaposition here, though, Cindy, because, you know, you have the Department of Education basically unilaterally, because I don't think they went to the legislature for this, now did they, turning back this money. So basically saying, well, we're just not going to do it. We're not going to take this part.
I'm going to break in for a second. Third Rail Politics, 3RD Rail Politics, all one word, 3RD for third. You need to go out and check this out. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. But basically, when it gets right down to it, Cindy, didn't the legislature, first of all, establish charter schools in Ohio? Secondly, have gone back time and time again to basically rein in the Department of Education from trying to do to run roughshod over the charters? I mean, I remember when I was still working in the legislature, and even afterwards when I was working with a number of different nonprofits, there's always been a fight over the department trying to basically set two different standards, you know, and creating hurdles that charters would not be able to meet so that they would be failing, so that they do not create the situation where kids in charters are succeeding and having educational achievement and the kids that are still in the public schools in many of these areas aren't, which, you know, we look at Cleveland as a big example of that. And didn't the legislature actually go to bat against the Obama administration and actually had to pass a law last session to get the money in the first place?
Yes, they did.
So you're telling me that the Department of Education and State Superintendent Paolo DiMaria, who has an interesting connect to Fordham himself, actually basically just told the legislature, we frankly don't care what you think. We're going to do whatever we feel like over here.
Right. And I would, if I could throw in.
Sure.
The Department of Education is operated with half of our state budget. We began by talking about the state budget.
Yes.
In fact, over half of the state budget goes to education, K through 12 education in the state of Ohio, and that doesn't include people's property taxes. So when you talk about, I would call this, I'm shocked this isn't the major news story in the state of Ohio, it certainly is for the blog. This is an epic, epic financial failure by the state of Ohio, and is an epic educational failure by the state of Ohio. You know, they want to focus on the electronic classrooms of tomorrow, saying that they only graduate 49% of the kids. They graduate 49% of the kids who would never have graduated before.
Yes.
They should be praised. They should be cheered for. They should be held up as an example of what is best and working and great. And you know what? They don't seem to want to talk about, I think they're frankly using ECOT as a diversion to the fact that 84% of our schools are failing. And you know what? Families and taxpayers, you should be incensed about that. You should be incensed that they brought common core state standards to the state of Ohio and that the outcome is this is not about teachers. We love our teachers. Our teachers don't want this. School superintendents don't want this. This is about a few people making a heck of a lot of money to get something done, and the impact of it is absolute epic devastation and financial devastation for our state. Where does the next workforce come from? Where are these kids going to go? Did you know that 18% of the kids in Ohio either don't graduate at all or they don't graduate on time? We have over 1 million people in the state of Ohio who do not have a degree. You talk about the weight of that on our. No wonder we're expanding Medicaid.
Yeah, well, and see, there you're making now you're making the linkages we like to make, which is when you do this one thing, we'll look at the cascading problems that it causes.
The law of unintended consequences. Essentially, you think you're solving one problem, and instead you're creating 10 others. Some of them more serious than the one you think you're solving.
Absolutely.
That's true. Now, Cindy, you know, this also comes at a time that I think it's very interesting because, again, this just shows you once more where the executive branch and one of their agencies have decided that they're going to make policy decisions and spending decisions, which is actually the purview of the General Assembly, because not more than 2 weeks ago, I remember seeing a press conference where Governor Kasich and Speaker Rosenberger and Senate President Obhoff had to sit down in front of a bunch of cameras and swallow real hard and say, oh, we goofed, and our budget is going to be out of balance because, well, we're spending about $800 million more than we're bringing in. And so we're going to have to cut this budget by almost $1 billion over the next 2 years in order to get it to balance. But the Department of Education just sent back almost $50 million in federal grant monies that probably are going to end up getting made up somewhere, I'm assuming, that because the legislature, by and large, seems to have a very warm place in their heart for charter schools, that maybe that at least part of that money, if not all of it, might actually get put back in. But the question is, where is it going to come from?
And it was... I know there are a lot of people who don't want to take money from the federal government because of the strings that are attached, and obviously with ComCorp and the Race to Top grant, there were strings attached. Mm-hmm. But we have a new president, and we have Betsy DeVos, and I realize that we still need to wait and see how that's going to play out, but obviously her career has been such that she has been supportive of local control, supportive of families making decisions for their children's education, fiscal responsibility for education. So to turn back $49 million because of these fake standards that they put into place when we're $800 million short is rather, it's actually shameful, I guess. I feel it's shameful. I don't know who's out there to stand up for the kids who have no voice, and that's with the kids in poverty. And I just really, these were the kids that they took that money from. And, you know, because I'll just be frank. I mean, you have all these groups out there who, if this had been in the reverse, they would be out demonstrating on the Capitol Square, right? And you took $49 million away from education, da, 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 da. And no, it's silent. It's cricket.
Well, yeah, you're right, because we took one.
The fact of the matter is, we have just damaged. You're right, absolutely. You know, in the school districts that have more money and they don't get any of the state money back, it's a shame because there's no hope for them to get any kind of return on their initial investment. For the folks who don't want to take the federal funds because of the stream, all I can say is federal tax dollars are your tax dollars that we should be bringing back to the state for our kids. And I agree, there should be strings attached. I think that local people know how, and I think parents know best how to educate and make those decisions for their children, not people who have no connection whatsoever to the state of Ohio. So I think there's a fight here that we need to take on. It's a real challenge because and I appreciate you even having me on the show to talk about the awareness of it, because again, when you have 84% of our schools failing, you have more than half of the state budget going to fund these failing schools, you're $800 million in the hole, and you're sending $49 million back. Poof, it's gone. Never getting it back, according to State Representative Andy Brenner, who's the education chair. You can't get that money back. It's gone.
Yeah.
I think there's something fundamentally wrong with the happening at the Ohio Department of Education, and I think that we need to be on top of that and express our great concern about that.
Right. Now, you had mentioned that, the $22 million that they did keep, that Fordham's going to directly benefit from that. Is that because the schools that are going to be qualifying, those four of the 64, is Fordham the sponsor of these charters?
Yeah, well, Fordham is a sponsor of 11 schools. The four are sponsors. So there's four sponsors, of which one is Fordham. Fordham is the only sponsor who's on the committee to examine how this is implemented.
Let me back up just a second, Cindy. Are you telling me and our listeners that a special interest group, the Fordham Institute, who is a recipient of the grant dollars, actually sits on the panel that decides how the grant dollars are distributed and what the requirements are for them?
Yes.
How does that happen when we have a inspector general and a legislative ethics committee and a state legislature who are supposed to be having some oversight? That, I mean, honestly, that doesn't pass the ethics smell test.
You know, even if it, let's say it should pass yet, if it did pass the ethics smell test for the state of Ohio, I don't think it passes the citizens of the state of Ohio's ethics smell test at all. And we continue to look into this because I would argue that there's clearly a serious issue with that kind of money being passed for Fordham. If you review the different committees, Fordham, they were the sponsor group that created the standards. They were the only player on a whole slew of these different committees that created this entire formula that seems to, at the end of the day, pretty much exclusively benefit them. And yes, I would argue that there's something there for the Inspector General to look at.
Okay, well,
and I would encourage him to do so.
And I would hope that that we would see a number of these schools and possibly the parents in these schools, not just the charter schools, but the 84% of the schools that are basically going to not pass the state report card, to say, hey, something's desperately wrong here. I mean, you know, and until you said that, it hadn't clicked into my head that the fox guarding the hen house is the basically standard operating procedure, it seems like, at the Department of Education.
It's absolutely amazing. So you have the Fordham Institute, one of their organizations that you created, the new director of the Department of Education works for, was the leader of, Paula DeMaio. And you'll see, and we're going to continue to do reporting on this, we're just finding constantly more and more connections between Fordham and the key players who are making all of these decisions. I would say that it's pretty much fair to say that Fordham Institute is pretty much running the Department of Education.
Well, yeah, I think it might be even
and
more fair.
It's not to the benefit of society. It's to their own personal benefit.
Well, that seems fairly obvious, yes.
If schools were doing better, that'd be awesome, right? I mean, great, that was probably an excellent decision. But you can't, damn it. You know, I talk about that child who was number one in their class, of a class that last year would have been number one school in the state. You can't pretend that this does not have an impact on our families, on our neighbors. This has a literal impact on the future of your children. If you look at your school's ranking, it is not what you think it is. I guarantee you my neighbors believe that they are paying enormous property taxes for the benefit of having their kids attend the number one school in the state of Ohio, and I believe they would be mortified if they learned that their school was seventh from the bottom.
Yeah, I think it'd probably be a little bit of a system shock. You know, Cindy, you know, both Chuck and I are free market advocates. You know, we believe that there ought to be competition. We believe that there ought to be a lot of privatization, especially among government services that don't have constitutional warrant, like education. But we believe in free markets, not in slave markets. And that's what it sounds like Fordham is looking to do, is to create a slave market where they're the only controller and everybody has to come to them. Now, you mentioned their connect and their influence with the Department of Education. But, you know, we had reported earlier on a previous program about some emails that your organization dug up that shows that they have a fairly significant influence, at least, with one of the chairs of the legislative education committees.
Yes, they do. They're very fortunate. Senator Peggy Lehner, who is from Dayton, from Kettering, where the Fordham Institute was founded, is their go-to person. She has hand-selected committees to look at sponsor rules. She was the woman who made all of the sponsor evaluation changes in her. It was House Bill 2, but the changes were made in the Senate and pushed through by Senator Peggy Lehner. So we've discovered that Senator Lehner's sister is the leader of one of the sub-organizations created and funded by the Fordham Institute. She never shared that information with anyone. And she would frequently bring her sister in to testify as
an expert witness. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, as an expert witness. I need you guys. Thank you. Expert witness. And never tell her peers in the Senate. Never. I mean, I've had more than one senator inform me that she had never mentioned that fact. So when, you know, creating meetings, the ethics questions actually go beyond just Fordham. I mean, I really feel that the ethics of Senator Lehner are in question, and the fact that she's been given this position of authority to manage education policy in the Senate should be very concerning to families in the state of Ohio. She owns these failures as does Fordham. Our state's We were number five in the nation I apologize, I can't remember the name of the study, but you can find it on our blog. We were number five, ranked number five in the country. We're now number 25. We fell 20 ranked states in 1 year, actually I think it was 2 years, because of these policies that these individuals put into place. And I've had more than one senator tell me that they of course assumed when she was bringing in these experts and talking about policy that they believed her because she's their peer. She never mentioned her relationship with any of those individuals. So my hunch is that now that some of this information is coming out, that perhaps when she stands up and speaks and brings in experts, hopefully they're asking more questions. But I can appreciate if I had been in the legislature and one of my peers brought in someone and said they were an expert, I probably would have just accepted that as well. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it isn't like they don't have a lot of people who come in and talk to them. You know, as we're talking about this budget process, there may be 800 or 900 people who testify on a budget in either chamber, both in the House and in the Senate, and especially if you've got like a controversial subject. But I mean, even so, you know, I think it would just be basically a measure of decorum and respect for your colleagues to say, by the way, you know, let me lay the cards on the table here. Interest of full disclosure, we're blood relatives. So even though she's independent and I don't, you know, and she's working for this organization, which, hey, don't look behind the curtain, but it's Fordham. Yeah. she's working for this independent organization. You shouldn't let the fact that she's my sister influence you that she knows more of what she's talking about than anybody, and so you should listen to what she says through me. Or something of that nature, right?
Information. When I started this job in September, the first thing I covered was this the state report card and the 84%. And you have to remember, I just came from 12 years of early education. So it meant something to me, not as much as it does now. And I knew Senator Langer. I'd worked with her, and I contacted her. And she gave me quite a bit of information, and all of it was actually very, very frightening for our kids. And led me to just keep digging into this, and the more I dig, the more shocking the influence that Lehner, Gates, and Fordham have on the policies that are being made for everyone. And you know what's interesting too? Look at the state report card. Kettering did very well. They actually jumped up. Isn't that interesting? Isn't it interesting that Fordham did really well in the Race to the Top grant distribution? Nobody else did.
Those happen to be coincidences, Cindy. Come on, Cindy. We know that those are just coincidences, and there's no collusion happening whatsoever, right?
Yeah. No. Well, I guess I say it needs to be looked into, and you know, I do. I would love to encourage the Inspector General to really take a look at this because obviously they're going to have much more. You know, doing the best we can, we're doing pretty well, and we really, really thank people for sending. I mean, somebody sent me, I have emails and documentation, I have all kinds of things, people calling, and I really, really appreciate the fact that people are really concerned about this and do forward their information in confidence, and we keep it in confidence so that we can continue to probe into this. This, what again I would argue, is an epic failure by the Department of Education and an epic financial failure. Mark my words, you have to cut $800 million out of the state budget. It's going to impact, even if you don't even have a child in school right now, it will impact something that matters to you because you're going to have to pull money from somewhere, from a program that you might care greatly, from an Alzheimer's program or, you know, from cancer research. They're going to pull money from places to be able to meet the obligations of our education system. And so you will ultimately be impacted. And you are also ultimately impacted when kids are not graduating and not going on to achieve success because we are losing people who benefit us as good, solid citizens who are working, paying taxes, raising kids who will move up and be well-educated as well. The impact of this is a cycle. And it's a very, very negative thing.
Well, Cindy, it sounds to me like at the very least, third rail politics is going to have quite a bit to write about as this goes on. Is there actually a Pulitzer Prize for blogs?
I have no idea.
Chances are not.
Chances are probably not. But if there is one, I think a lot of what you're doing out there might qualify for it because, you know, you said you touch what they won't. I know you're a media devourer as well. Have you seen much of this stuff anywhere else? I mean, maybe the paper of record in Ohio, the Columbus Dog Patch, will sometimes throw a little bone out there about something, but usually it's only because somebody else stirred the pot.
Well, I haven't seen anything anyplace else, and the Dayton papers are quiet about it, which isn't a shock. The Dayton Daily Worker and the Columbus Debauch and around here, unfortunately, I'm rural, so the paper here is the Newark Aggravate. And my daughter is actually she is the office manager at the Licking County Department of history, or Licking County Historical, Historical Society. And we were kind of laughing about the fact that the aggravate, when they send over information about something that the Historical Society is running, the aggravate, despite the fact that they get talked to at least three times and given the proper dates and having it by email, by phone, any way possible, they always manage to misprint it. So even if the newspapers got the story, would they get it right? And the fact is, I've been watching your particular blog, thirdrailpolitics.com. I've been watching it on this controversy about Judge Tyack in Franklin County and the ECOT. There's a lawsuit, apparently, and he has shown extreme prejudice from the bench against ECOT, and even the Columbus debauch called for him to step aside in the case. And of course, you ran a piece on a flaming liberal attorney who essentially came out and defended Judge Tyack, who has all kinds of interesting ties himself. I mean, the attorney. So, you know, even when the press gets it right, usually they don't get it right.
You know, on investigative reporting, I think because of just that we're going through a transition nationally, I guess, in terms of labor, and obviously with electronic media, et cetera, but there really aren't a lot of investigative reporters working anymore. They just don't have time. And I guess I'm bragging, and I'll brag for my writers, but I think the amount of work that we have put into this to uncover the story it has been enormous. And it's absolutely, the story, if you're going to start a blog, what a gift. And I had no idea. I'm telling you, I had no idea. It happened to be the day that they released this report card. And it just took off because who would have ever thought that a judge would come out on the bench and make such a scathing comment and be so incredibly biased? And the fact that our friends on the left are trying to support the judge, you know, you have to ask yourself if you think that kind of bias from the bench is okay, what happens when it's in reverse? What happens if a conservative judge was measuring your key issue or your passion issue, and said those types of things? I just don't think that would be considered right.
Well, there would be rioting in the streets. What's interesting is the there would be a rent-a-mob tomorrow, essentially.
Exactly.
And you would send a real investigative reporter out to ask the rent-a-mob members individually what they were mobbing over, and most of them would not know.
Okay, this is not related to our subject at all, but we did cover Congressman Jim Jordan on President's Day, and he was talking about the Affordable Care Act at the Harding Memorial, and we literally watched people get off the bus. They were not, I walked through the crowd, they were not from the area, they were not from the congressman's district. It was, they're highly organized, they know what they're doing, but I think it's the duty of a reporter. I think the job is to tell the truth and uncover the truth. And so if there's I think it doesn't suffice to say there were 300 people there. I think you have to explain that of the 300, this small little contingent that was hovering over on the side and frankly very nervous and uncomfortable were his actual constituents, and they had no opportunity whatsoever to ask questions. I mean, the congressman would have clearly answered his questions. He was completely open to it. But an event that was meant for them was completely hijacked by the left.
Co-opted, and you see that more and more. Now, Cindy, I wanted to throw something out. We've only got a few minutes left, but I did want to throw something out because, as I mentioned, you know, the 14 pages of single space bullet pointed changes to the budget. There were a couple things in here as you were talking. I was glancing over it, and I want to get your take on it. I just want to throw it out there. There's a provision in the substitute version of the budget that basically says that it's going to, first of all, it allows the Department of Education and the State Board of Education to have access to the SSID numbers, that's the individual student identifier numbers, to be matched to personally identifiable student data for the purposes of making per pupil payment to community schools. Now, there is an awful lot of uproar right now among many people, parents especially, about the limitation or the non-use of personally identifiable information, the SSIDs, on students. Is this something that and it says it allows them to do it, so ODEs most likely come and ask them for that ability to do so. Is this another means of basically throwing a roadblock at the charter schools?
I imagine that it is.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, and this has been something that, again, our friends on the left have been really driving for, and they call, you know, we need information, we need people to measure, we need accountability, we need all of these wonderful words. But in reality, what they really mean is they want to be able to control. And, you know, what they can provide per pupil funding without them. It's been happening.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, why in the world would the State Board of Education need to have personally identifiable and matched student identification information for kids who are going to community schools if it isn't anything other than for that information to be used in order to basically maybe put pressure on the parents?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought of it that way. I considered that it was a tool to try to... I thought they were using it, excuse me, sorry for babbling for a moment, but
no.
I personally thought that the purpose was to be able to use it to track measurements, to be able to ensure that they could find ways to not give the school the funds.
Well, that could very well be as well.
But you're right. I mean, well, it's interestingly enough, that could be the deeper layer that I hadn't even considered. Because there isn't, if you look at education policy, there isn't a lot of, there seems to be little confidence in parents and parents' ability to make decisions for their own children across the board. Doesn't matter where you live. And they know best, right? The government, they know best. They know best, Gary.
I've heard that said a number of times. I still don't believe it, but that's okay.
So, you know, let's tattoo these kids, give them a number, follow them, and the second they don't log in or the second they aren't, achieving X, Y, and Z, they're out. You know, there's been, ignore the charters for a moment, there's been a lot of reports about public schools expelling kids because it's all about these measurements. Man-made measurements. It's so frustrating. So
yes.
Schools don't want to be dinged if their kids aren't performing really well. So what do? They find reasons to expel kids who are troubled and really probably need the safety and protection and mentoring and all of the wonderful things that you get at school the most. Because these false measurements were created and falsely punished schools based on something that is really, frankly, beyond their control. So you raise a good question.
Okay, well, hopefully it's one that Third Rail Politics will dig into. And folks, first of all, we want to thank Cindy for being such a great guest who stayed on with us for about the whole hour.
That's right.
And she's willing to give her time this way when she probably could be spending it better going out there and digging into the emails and traffic between all these agencies to find out what's going on. But she does a lot of that as well. And I would just really commend to all of our listeners, first of all, keep Cindy and Third Rail Politics in your prayers. And secondly, go out to the blog site. It's 3RDRailPolitics.com. 3RDRailPolitics, all crunched together, no spaces, .com. And read some of the articles, the series on poverty is great. These articles about what's going on with the interconnect between the department and the superintendent and the education committees and this private entity down in Kettering. These are all things you need to know about because they're going to affect your kids in your schools sooner or later. So, Cindy, want to thank you very much for being so willing to come on, and it's a great interview. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, Barry. And we greatly appreciate your prayers, because the mission is really to shine light on things that are going on, and definitely need to be sure that we are making the right judgments. And if I could just add one last thing, Franklin Graham encouraged people of faith to run for school boards and all elected offices, and I really encourage your listenership to pray on that, because you are needed.
Well, thank you very much. And, okay, if you want to know more about this, again, we've mentioned thirdrailpolitics.com. Also, principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And I'll say that again as we end. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.